You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
So over the course of the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing something that's, it's kind of dumb. And I mean dumb in the sense that, like, it's not dumb in the sense that we shouldn't do it. I mean, it's dumb in the sense that it's like, it's a hard thing to attempt, but we're going to attempt it regardless. And the difficult thing that we're going to attempt is we're going to try to take 2 weeks and cover all seven of the churches that are laid out for us in Revelation 2 and 3. That's a big task because honestly, like, each one of these seven churches could be, perhaps even should be, their own standalone sermons, but we've got places to go. We've got to get to Revelation 4. We can't wait around just sitting here dwelling with these churches for 2 months. So, we're going to be sprinting through, these seven churches. And so, as we kind of step into that mode, we're going to actually walk through these four churches, look at them up close in just a minute. But I want to set the framework, because really the reason why I think this is even possible is because there's a framework that John is setting up for us. Actually, that I think Jesus is setting up for us, a lens through which we can understand, that the things going on in these churches, though they're diverse, they're different, and the nuances are different from church to church to church. It essentially, like, there is just a handful of things that are being repeated over and over and over again with all seven of these churches. So in some sense, like, we're trying to do too much in the next 2 weeks. In another sense, like, the next 2 weeks are going to be pretty repetitive, but because we're looking at really the same exact scenario played out in different, slightly different circumstances as we move through these seven churches. But to do that, I want to take us back a little bit to last week. Part of that is I wasn't here, so I don't know what Jay said. Maybe he said crazy things. And part of it is too, I think it's really important to keep in mind that the vision of Jesus that John saw right before Jesus begins to address the churches. Jesus doesn't just come kind of as this arbitrary word kind of sent out into space that John hears and begins to write down. That John is reporting things to these churches in light of who he saw Jesus to be in the verses we looked at last week, or that you looked at last week. And I don't want to work our way verse by verse through that, but I want to remind you of how Jesus portrayed himself, that the scene that John saw, that is the scene in which Jesus begins to address these seven churches and begins to address us. And that brings up a point, even before we do that, that the book of Revelation as a whole, and I think this is really important as we study it over the next few months, and as we try to listen to the words that John says in this book, one of the things that's most important to keep in mind as we study this book is it was written to particular Christians in a particular situation at a particular time. In other words, the book of Revelation wasn't just this generically written kind of vision of the far-off future. Jesus is actually trying to do something for people who are really in trouble and really facing troubling circumstances at that time and in that moment. In other words, anytime we step into different parts of the book of Revelation, so when we get to, say, Revelation 20, Revelation 9, we have these crazy visions of Jesus, or we have these visions of what's happening in history, and they're really, really hard to understand. One of the most important things that we can keep in mind, that we can remember, is Jesus is actually addressing real Christians in a city called Ephesus who are struggling with real sin, real temptation, real struggles, real pain, that they're watching things unfold in their lives, and Jesus is trying to help them make sense of it. In other words, he's not just saying, hey, so, I know it's hard right now, but someday, like several thousand years from now, here's the things that are going to happen. Now, what he's saying is, hey, right now, you're in the midst of trouble. Right now, you're facing, like, economic, financial decisions for your family. Like, we're going to see in just a minute. Like, it's that practical, these verses. You're addressing how do you put food on the table for your family right now. To another church, he's addressing, hey, you're afraid you might be dragged off and thrown in prison. He's addressing real issues that are facing these churches at that particular moment, at that particular time. Now, that doesn't mean it's irrelevant to us. Far from it. I think it's deeply relevant to us. But for us to hear that word for us today, we first have to step in and listen to that word as it's being spoken to and addressed to these particular people in these particular situations. Now, who is this Jesus is addressing his churches? The text last week from the back half of chapter 1 portrayed Jesus as John hears a voice that sounds like many waters, a voice that sounds like thunder. In other words, it sounds like a roar. And then he says he turns and he beholds this Jesus who's now going to be in this chapter addressing the church. And what he sees is amazing. And it's amazing because of its immediate relevance, not only to these churches, although that's stunning, but also its immediate relevance to us sitting in this room right now. The primary thing that I would like to hold out to you in what he sees about who Jesus is he sees Jesus as a high priest. And he sees him walking in the midst of a temple, and in that temple are lampstands. And John tells us, kind of interpreting the vision as it lays before us, that those lampstands are churches. There's seven lampstands, there's seven churches. And so the vision that John sees, in fact, how we're supposed to understand Jesus as he's speaking to these churches, is he's a priest. And he's a priest who's doing kind of his day-to-day work in the temple. In the first century, in fact, in all of the centuries leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, when priests worked in the temple, they had not just kind of jobs of like leading worship services and teaching the Bible. They actually had to do like very, very tangible, practical things. There were things that were supposed to go on day in and day out in the life of the temple. And one of the things that they had to do is within the holy place, like before the throne of God, before the presence of God, so not all the way in the temple, not where God himself dwelled, but just outside was seven lampstands. Those lampstands were made to look like trees, and they were oil lampstands, so they would burn with flames of fire meant to represent the Spirit of God and meant to represent the presence of God. And the job of the priest is really, really practical. Like, they were to trim the wicks. They were to make sure that there was oil in the basins. They were to polish the sides of these lampstands to make sure they stayed beautiful and weren't dirty. They were to decide if the lampstands were broken. If they were broken, they needed to be replaced. They needed to be moved. They would make sure that everything was in order. Everything was as it should be with those lampstands and with everything that was taking place within the holy place. And so here's the beauty of what Jesus is doing as he addresses us and he addresses his churches. He says, I'm a high priest and you're a lampstand. And what I'm doing in speaking to you, what I'm doing in writing these letters to you, particularly in chapters 2 and 3, is I'm tending to the lampstands. The beauty of that is one of the most obvious things in the world, but it's beautiful. It tells us that Jesus isn't far off, kind of throwing criticism at these churches. See, he's right there in the midst of them. That he's right here in the midst of this body, this community, this church, doing the work that he does, trimming the wicks, filling it with oil, polishing, fixing, repairing, disciplining, but also caring for. And this is how John sees Jesus. He sees him as holy. He sees him as glorious. He sees him again with the language that he used even from the first half of chapter 1. This is going to be a reoccurring theme. He sees Jesus as the conquering Son of Man, this kind of hero figure that was that's sent by the Ancient of Days in the book of Daniel to conquer evil and to rescue God's people. But at the heart of this image of Jesus' authority, of Jesus' holiness, of his power, of all these other things, is Jesus functioning as a high priest, caring for his people, caring for his church. Now, at the heart of that is an understanding of the church that I think is something that we perhaps have lost in our day. It's the church not merely as kind of a collection of individuals who happen to show up this morning in this room to sing some songs and listen to a sermon and then leave as a collection of individuals. You see, the church, as it's portrayed basically everywhere in the New Testament, but maybe especially in the book of Revelation, it is seen more as a collective body, as a community, as a family, as a almost as a person itself. That the way that John sees the church is not as individual lamps, so that sitting in this room is, say, 60 lamps that are all burning and we're all individuals, we're all going to go burn in our different parts of the city. And what he says is, No, we collectively, in our life together, in our worship together, in our eating meals together, in our caring for one another, in our loving one another, in our doing life in and out together, that somehow, in some mysterious way, that represents a witness to the reign and the goodness of Jesus. So that the power of the church is not fundamentally individuals, it's fundamentally our life together, our worship together, our eating together, our laughing together. Like, this is what it means to be the church. Not just kind of this volunteer thing that you show up, like you go to a movie this afternoon. Although I'm hoping to go see a movie for Father's Day today. Like, you all showed up and decided this was the movie you're going to go to today. And it's me. it's Mr. Incredible. The idea, no, is instead that we are together, a community, a family, a body, knit together, that in our life together, that represents a lampstand, that represents the sign of God's presence in the world. It's a beautiful vision of the church that we're going to continue to explore as we work our way through the book of Revelation. But at the very least, it means as we listen to John's words, I would challenge you not first to hear them as an individual, challenging you personally. Oh, I think it should and it will. But rather to help us think together as a community that John is speaking to us as a church, that Jesus, through John rather, is speaking to us as a community, warning us, encouraging us, comforting us, calling us to something as a body first, and then as individuals. So, but what does Jesus address? So we're going to look at these four churches, and I'm going to look at it in a way that hopefully makes sense to you. So first we're going to address the city. What is this city? What's going on in this city? What is important for us to know about that city, particularly as we begin to hear the words of Jesus? One of the things we're going to find is that everything Jesus says, like literally to the point that we could go on for hours and hours about each of these cities, but each of the things that Jesus says to these churches, and there's a really great book if you want to know about it. We can talk after, but where Jesus actually is addressing the particular historical cultural situation in each of these cities individually. So just as an example, Jesus is portrayed as having feet of bronze, and the feet of bronze in the Old Testament is kind of and even within the first century is a sign of holiness, a sign of kind of righteous living, like where you walk in holiness. But it's addressed specifically to a church, and in that city, as Jesus is presented to the one with feet like bronze, it was like, that's a weird thing to bring up at that moment. It's important to know in that city, that was one of the primary cities where currency was produced for the empire, and guess what kind of currency it was? Bronze coins. Isn't that amazing? This next two chapters, no one cares. I think it's awesome. So the next two chapters are just filled with all kinds of little trivia like that, where Jesus is addressing, speaking to these churches in ways that would have made particular sense to the situation and the history and the story that they have. And so I'm just going to bring up a couple of those things with these four churches. So we're going to talk about the city. Secondly, he addresses particular situations that the church in that city is facing. And we're going to find that those situations are fairly limited. They're pretty much the same. Now, the situation facing the church, the thing that's different is the church. Is it a faithful church? Is it an unfaithful church? Is the church being tempted in one direction or the other? And there's really only two directions they're being tempted in. And so we're going to look at the particular situation they're facing. And then last, Jesus, in calling them to faithfulness and calling them to not give in to temptation and calling them to persevere through whatever the situation is that they're facing, he gives each of them a promise. And that promise, again, is very much situated in the city, in the cultural situation that they're facing. So we're going to look at that. So that's how we're going to look at it. The city, the situation, and the promise. So we're going to take the first four churches today, and then I'll wrap it up with a nice bow, and then we'll come back next week and do the same thing, only with three churches, which will be way faster and more fun. Okay. Here we go. Jenny's telling me to hurry. All right. So the first church he addresses is the church in Ephesus. Now this is kind of everybody's favorite church to talk about. It's the easiest one to preach because he says you left your first love, and that's an easy phrase to preach, right? I can just say that. Everybody knows that that's a very important thing to say. And so the very first city he addresses is the city in Ephesus. A couple of things you need to know about the city of Ephesus. One, the church started in the city of Ephesus, and you can read about this in the book of Acts. It started in the city of Ephesus out of an enormous kind of violent conflict between Paul and the purveyors of kind of the marketplace that centered around the temple to Artemis. A riot breaks out. It's actually kind of a humorous story in the book of Acts. I would encourage you to go and find it and read about it. But the thing I want you to know is the church is born in the city of Ephesus out of massive conflict between the Christians and the culture. Their worship of Jesus, the effectiveness of them calling their neighbors to come and worship Jesus, started affecting not just kind of the religious life of the city. It actually began affecting the economic life of the city. It began affecting the marketplace and businesses. It began to touch everything. Ephesus is actually a beautiful example of how Christianity is not meant to merely kind of fall in the religious sphere. It should actually affect everything about a city. Edgewater, West Denver should be different because people are worshiping Jesus, because more people are worshiping Jesus, which should have effects on the kind of work that people do. It should have effects on the kinds of things that people spend their money on and how families function and what schools look like. It should begin to affect everything. And so the church, as it arises in the city of Ephesus, it arises in the midst of massive conflict with the city that's surrounding it. In Ephesus, there's a massive Jewish population, and we see that the church, as we kind of navigate through these, is constantly trying to navigate between their relationship to the Jewish people and their relationship to the pagan culture that surrounded them and the Jewish people. And there's constantly a temptation that these churches are facing to turn to the one side and kind of, if you were a Jew in the first century, you were tolerated within Roman society. You didn't have to worship all the Roman gods. You kind of had your own city. You kind of had your own functioning culture and society and marketplace within the city. One of the ways that the church was tempted was to kind of like just start hanging out within kind of the Jewish ghetto of the city. Kind of functioning within their marketplace, their culture, their place, which meant they were pulled to certain kinds of compromises that would call them to, or because maybe they were being rejected by the Jewish side of the city, to kind of err on the other side, and to hang out within pagan culture, within Roman culture, which would have led to a whole different set of kinds of compromises and sin. And so within Ephesus, we know that there's a pretty massive Jewish population, that is, pretty neutral with regards to how it related to the church. We know historically, the Jews in Ephesus were fairly, friendly to the church, fairly friendly to Christians. They tolerated the existence of Christianity, but there was this massive conflict, with the larger society, around them. The second thing you need to know about the city of Ephesus, it was known as an asylum city, perhaps the most famous asylum city, in all the Roman Empire. And by asylum city, what I mean by that is if, I decided one day I lived out in a village, and I saw Ty, and I was in a bad mood that day. And so I took my fists, and I beat up Ty, and took his donkey, and decided I wanted to take his donkey. And then suddenly, a couple hours later, I realized, man, that was a fit of stupidity and violence. And so I don't want to get thrown in jail, and Caitlin's going to come after me and have me thrown in jail because she loves her husband. Rather than stay and face the consequences, I'm going to flee to Ephesus. And if I flee to Ephesus, within Ephesus, there is a giant tree in the middle of Ephesus on the tree of Artemis. And surrounding the tree of Artemis is a wall with some huts and some places to live. If I can make it into that, within that wall, and get to the tree before Caitlin and her guards, because they're a wealthy family that has their own guards, before they come and they attack me and arrest me and probably have me beaten, maybe killed because Ty was a prominent member of society. If I can make it to Ephesus and I can get into the wall, the fortress of Artemis, and I can get close to the tree of Artemis, which was called the tree of life, if I can get next to the tree of life, then my life will be spared. And that will be a very, very good thing. And so that was one of the reasons why the city was well known and famous. One, because of the Temple of Artemis. Second, because of this tree that existed right there in the middle of the city. And it was a place where everyone knew if you do something stupid, you can flee to Ephesus and you get to live there the rest of your life. But you don't have to be arrested or killed. And so that was the city of Ephesus. Now, what is the situation that the church is facing? The church is existing in this city, and Jesus begins to address this church. He begins to address a problem. Again, the situation that they're facing is the same situation we're going to see with all the churches, but which is either you begin to kind of assimilate into the surrounding pagan culture that was marked deeply by sexual immorality and sexual confusion. It was marked deeply by idolatry. To participate in the culture that surrounded kind of the pagan Roman culture that surrounded him required some level of sacrifice to idols. It required some level of compromise sexually. It required all kinds of just kind of giving into the culture. And it was different in different places, different there was a kind of different kinds of pressures in different cities, as we'll see. But that was one of the ways that you could live at peace as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus in the world, is if you could find inroads to make peace with the surrounding culture, to kind of not be so kind of sexually uptight, maybe like go participate in the feast where they would ostensibly worship other gods. You could just kind of show up, keep your head down, you know, mouth a prayer, something like that. Find yourself at home and at peace in the culture. You would be tolerated as a Christian. You'd be thought odd, but you're at least kind of there. You're not an oddball. You're not against anything that's happening in the culture. You're just there and accepted, and you can kind of hide out and not be persecuted. Or your other option before you was you could see the evils that were surrounding you in the culture, and you could say, hey, we're going to hide out with the Jewish people. We're going to act like Jews. We're going to eat like Jews. We're going to talk like Jews. We're going to be condemning of the pagan culture that surrounds us and the idolatry that surrounds us and the sexual immorality that surrounds us. And we're going to hang out over here with the Jews. Now the compromise over here was a little bit different because Jews would tolerate you as so long as kind of your outward life, kind of kept yourself clean from what was happening in the surrounding culture. But if you talked about Jesus too much, that would get you in trouble with the Jewish people. They didn't want you talking about Jesus. They wanted you to live like a Jew, act like a Jew, talk like a Jew. And if you worship Jesus, that might be okay, but kind of keep that to yourself. And so that was kind of the two situations facing all of the churches. And in Ephesus, John points out, hey, you've learned to hate the right things. It's interesting, right? He says, you've departed from your first love, and you hate the Nicolaitans. And then hating the Nicolaitans is he considers that to be a good thing, but you've departed from your first love. And listen to that. We see that, particularly even knowing the history of the church, the temptation that church is being pulled into is not that they're siding with the Nicolaitans. The Nicolaitans is some sort of incipient teaching in the church that basically kind of gave permission to Christians to say, hey, you can go and live like pagans. You can go and embrace all the things that are happening in the culture and remain faithful to Jesus, and that becomes a way of you engaging the culture. Many scholars think it was kind of almost a missional or an evangelistic kind of theology that began to arise in the church of saying, hey, how do we live in a culture that is hostile to the tenets of Christianity, hostile to the practices of Christianity, hostile to the morality and ethics of Christianity? Well, one way you can do it is say, hey, you can go and engage it, be aware of it, participate in it to some level. So long as your heart remains with Jesus, then you'll be okay. So what Jesus says to the church in Ephesus is you hate the teachings of the Nicolaitans. You don't buy that for a second. In other words, you've refused to kind of compromise with the immorality, compromise with the confusion, compromise with the idolatry and the paganism. And that's a good thing. Jesus commends the church for that. But he says, I have this against you. You departed from your first love. There's a danger facing the church in Ephesus, and dare I say a danger facing us as a church, that we can see all the problems in the world around us. We can see the moral problems, the ethical problems, the idolatrous problems that surround the surround us in the world that we live. And Christianity can become for us a kind of badge of morality or a badge of religiosity. And what John describes that as is you lose your first love. In other words, Christianity is no longer about Jesus. It's no longer about an obsession with being overwhelmed by the beauty, the glory, and the work of Jesus on the cross on our behalf. But instead, it becomes about acting right. It becomes about taking the right political positions. It becomes about taking the right moral positions over against the culture that surrounds us. Now, don't mishear me. What John is calling us to, what Jesus is calling us to, is not an either-or situation. There are things that we are called to hate. But the danger is you can hate all the right things and not love the one thing you were called to love with all of your life. That's Ephesus, the problem. And then Jesus makes a promise to Ephesus. He says that if you conquer, if you persevere, if you remain faithful, if you repent and come back and love me and bear witness to me, and a lot of scholars have associated this departing from your first love as like a refusal to speak about Jesus, refusal to talk about the majesty and the glory and the beauty of Jesus. If you begin to speak of me again, if you begin to love me again and love me with all of your life, I will give you to eat from the tree of life in the paradise of God. I'm holding up an alternative to the tree of life in the city of Ephesus, which everyone knew was destroying the city. I mean, imagine for a second, over centuries, criminals from all over the empire, they go to one city, like Ephesus. After like a few generations, that's problematic, right? Like, here's a tree of life that doesn't transform, tree of life that doesn't create a paradise, actually. Here's a tree of life that actually is unraveling the social fabric of the city itself. And what Jesus holds up to this church is say, hey, I want you to love me. I want you to keep hating the things you hate, but I want you to love me with all of your life and bear witness to who I am. And if you'll do that, and there will be consequences, then I'm going to give you to eat from the real tree of life. The place where you'll find real asylum, you'll find real forgiveness, and you'll find real transformation. Let's go to the second city, and I'm going to go faster now. I sort of promise. So the church in Smyrna. So the city of Smyrna is an interesting city. The one thing I want you to know about the city of Smyrna is it had a history of earthquakes. And the city, as you should never do, when you're in a region where there's lots of earthquakes, you should never put your city on the side of a cliff. They put this city on the side of a cliff. And in that region, there were earthquakes. And somewhere around 100, probably around 150 years prior to this letter being written, the city was completely wiped out by an earthquake. I mean, utterly destroyed. And then Rome spent an enormous amount of money, raised an enormous amount of taxes, and they rebuilt the city of Smyrna in the exact same spot, on the side of a cliff, which lets you know that, hey, this is just going to happen again. Like, it's just bound to happen. But they invested an enormous amount of money in making this city beautiful. And actually, the city was known and is referred to it in all of the literature as the crown jewel of the Roman Empire. It was this beautiful, beautiful city that people wanted to visit. But it was a city that had died and then come back to life because Rome had just decided they were going to invest an enormous amount of money in this city. And so that's kind of at the heart of the history of the city of Smyrna. Now, the situation that they're facing is that they are facing persecution from what John calls the Jews who aren't Jews. They're actually a part of the synagogue of Satan. One of the things that arises in John's understanding of the world is that Jewishness, because of Jesus, is no longer an ethnicity. It is about attachment to Jesus, whatever your ethnicity. And so what Jesus says to this church is, hey, there is a rising the possibility of persecution, and it's coming for you. In fact, it's not only a possibility, it's a certainty. Some of you are going to be taken into prison, and he begins to hint to them and say, look, some of you are going to be called to be faithful even unto death. Persecution is rising from the Jewish authorities. What we know is beginning to happen in the culture at the time, Christians have been able to kind of hide out in one or the other. But Jews are starting to get wise to the fact that if they want to get rid of the Christians, they have to go join forces with the Roman pagans and point out the fact that these Christians, they're not Jews and they're not worshiping the idols, that they're potentially a menace to society. And so the church in Smyrna is facing the certainty they're about to be persecuted. Some of them are going to be killed. They're going to face all kinds of problems that are coming at them. And that's the situation that they're facing. And then Jesus makes them a promise. He says that if they conquer, if they persevere in this faithfulness, they will receive one, they'll receive the crown of life. Again, a direct kind of counter to the whole narrative of this city, the city that is the crown jewel of the Roman Empire, and to that they will not be hurt by the second death, a death that everyone knows in Smyrna is coming. The earthquake is coming. It's going to mean the second death of this city. And secondly, this city is the crown jewel, the crown that marks life for the Roman Empire. And Jesus says, no, instead of that happening, no, if you'll persevere, even if it means facing death, even if it means being thrown into prison, you won't be hurt by the second death, the real second death. And I give you and you as a community, you will be the crown of life. Third church, Pergamum. Pergamum, John addresses, Jesus addresses in stark language. He says it is the place where Satan's throne is. So a couple of things that we need to know about the background to the city of Pergamum. One, it was one of the most prominent Roman cities in terms of its importance. The reason why it was so important is that in Pergamum was kind of the first place that emperor worship kind of arose within the empire. What you need to know about this is at some point in the first century, what had been kind of like this kind of hidden kind of cult in different places throughout the Roman Empire became prominent. And the place that it became prominent was in Pergamum. And that cult, that practice was the worship of the emperor himself. That whoever was emperor at the time was esteemed to be at the very least, like a god and likely to become a god after he died. And these emperors were seen as the bringers of peace. They were seen as the ones who brought righteousness and holiness. And to the earth, they were the ones who conquered the earth and brought the reign, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of the divine to the earth. Sounds terrifying, right? But you start to understand how the language of the early church was in direct conflict and could be seen as threatening to the early Romans. And so in the city of Pergamum, kind of this idea of worshiping the emperor, this idea of honoring the emperor, honoring Rome as kind of the highest good, and the Roman emperor is the highest deity, the most powerful deity in the universe. This is where it arose. It arose in Pergamum. Because of that kind of prominence within the city, to participate in the social life, the economic life, the cultural life of the city, you had to participate, you had to compromise, you had to make sacrifices to the emperor. If you wanted to participate in anything that was happening around you, if you wanted to be able to provide for your family, in other words, religion in the first century was not just something kind of off to the side. It was an integral part of the economic life, the financial life, and the cultural life of the city. If you wanted to have friends, if you wanted to be able to eat, if you wanted to be able to work, if you wanted people to buy things from you, or you didn't even have the resources necessary to make things to sell, you had to participate in the kind of cults, the kind of, we would almost think of them as social, religious, economic clubs that kind of ran throughout the city. You had to be endorsed by these kind of clubs that were all tied to the emperor, that were all tied to cultural life in the city, tied to idolatrous worship. You had to be accepted and kind of named by one of these groups. And to be accepted and named by one of these groups meant you had to be seen as not a threat, but as someone who endorsed, embraced, blessed, the kind of cultural life, the kind of sexual immorality and paganism that surrounded them. And so, one of the ways that this would work in that city, they were kind of like, a city filled with secret societies that everyone had to belong to. I have a friend who was a member of a secret society, and this reminds me of it. And in these secret societies, you would be given a stone, and on this stone would be written a name. That was your name as a member of that secret society. No joke. And to be a part of that secret society, you would go to these secret dinners. At those secret dinners, there would be some, kind of different kinds of secret dinners, but, at that dinner, you'd be given food. There'd be a feast. There'd be, food served. There'd usually be some sort of, sexual things that would happen at these feasts. And then that meant that was kind of your group, and that was a group that would support you, that would take care of you, that would endorse you, that would endorse your business. If you wanted to flourish in the city, you had to belong to one of those. In order to belong to one of those, you needed to be very, very outwardly seen as a good member of society that supported and endorsed the government, that supported and endorsed the emperor, that worshiped all things Rome. Could you worship Jesus and do that? Sure. Yeah, Jesus can be like the emperor and like all the other things that you worship. But you have to do this in addition to worshiping Jesus. So the compromise, the situation that they're facing, is that Jesus looks at this church and says, you have a genuine love for me. You talk about me. Your works are actually increasing, the good things that you're doing in the city. So here's a church that is in a city like this, a city where there's enormous pressure on them to participate in the social, cultural, idolatrous, religious life of the city. And we'll get to that, how they're relating to that in a second. But in the midst of all of that, they're still talking about Jesus. They're gathering for worship. They love Jesus. They talk about Jesus. And constantly being pulled to compromise, constantly being pulled to, alongside Jesus, worship what everybody else worships, alongside Jesus, to kind of lower their standards of what good, holy living looks like, to lower their definitions of sexual morality, to change how they view their social and cultural life in the city. They'll talk about Jesus, but it's easy to talk about Jesus in that situation so long as you're doing and saying and all the things that your neighbors are doing and saying. It's fine to talk about Jesus so long as you look and act like everybody else. Jesus calls them to stop. He calls them to repent. He calls them to turn back, to stop tolerating the Nicolaitans, that kind of false teaching that's permeating the church. And if you will, he makes this promise. He says, I'll give you the hidden manna and a stone with a new name. Oh, you'll belong to a new secret society. You'll be given a name that no one knows. And I'll give you some of the hidden manna. You'll have the feast that I provide. We'll come back to that at the end. Last church. Oh, man. Thyatira. So here's the thing about, you need to know about Thyatira. Thyatira is the most average, unremarkable city anywhere. Like, we don't really know anything about Thyatira because nobody cared about Thyatira in the first century. Got it? Great. There are basic things that he's trying to address here. One, in a city that doesn't have any prominence, it's clearly the temptation for them is, again, back towards compromise, the Nicolaitan teaching. He talks about Jezebel. Jezebel, we don't think, was this woman's real name. But Jezebel represented this figure from the Old Testament, this teacher that's calling this church and teaching very, very subtly this church to say, hey, we can engage the culture. We can live like our neighbors. We can be just like our neighbors in all of their morality and all their religiosity, and we can be faithful to Jesus. And you can understand the deep things of Satan, which is just, seems obvious to me, right? Like, if somebody stands up here one Sunday and says, I want to teach you today about the deep things of Satan, you should leave. So, quickly, because weird things are probably going to happen. But that's the pull, that's the temptation this church is facing. And they're facing that in a city that has no power, in a city that has no glory. In order for them just to exist, for them just to eat, they feel like they need to compromise. The pull is to kind of look like the culture around them. This kind of justifiable pressure to compromise. And so what does Jesus promise them? I told you I'd do that one fast. He promises them that he will give them a rod of iron. In other words, he will give them authority. He will give them power. And then he uses this phrase that they will be the morning star. Here's an image of glory and beauty. So in a city that had no authority and a city that had no glory or beauty to speak of, the promise of Jesus to this church is, you will be faithful to me. Get rid of these false teachers and kind of pull back from this temptation to compromise the world around you. I'll give you real authority. I'll give you real power, and I'll give you real glory. Now, where does all that leave us as we wrap things up? I think these two temptations are the same temptations that every church in every age faces. And frankly, I think they're not just temptations for churches. I think they're temptations for us as individuals as well. That as God gives shape and life to this church, the temptation, the pull for us as a community and for us as people is always going to be in one of two directions. One, towards the kind of temptations faced by the church in Ephesus. This kind of moralism, this kind of religiosity, this kind of moral self-righteousness in which we do all the right things, in which we take all the right positions, and kind of view ourselves as kind of the moral police of the world. And at the heart of what begins to unravel for us is a real affectionate love for Jesus that is transformative to who we are. I think that temptation faces every church. And I think if we went around this room and talked about the churches that we grew up in, but we could see that many of those churches kind of were pulled in that direction. They taught us how to think the right thoughts. They taught us how to have the right theology. They taught us to hate the right things. They taught us to boycott the right things. They taught us to have kind of suspect eyes as we looked at the culture around us, oftentimes in really good ways. But what was shriveling on the vine was a real love for a real Jesus that we knew, that we encountered, that we desired, that we trusted as the one who'd redeemed us and rescued us. On the other side of things is I think like there's this constant temptation, this constant pull to kind of have a vibrant language about Jesus. I think even oftentimes starts as just a deep love for Jesus and awareness of the grace that's been shown to us and an inability to recognize that the dangers that surround us, that we are immersed in a culture that does not acknowledge or submit to or honor the authority of Jesus and his word. And the subtle temptation, and I think, again, many of us grew up in churches like this, grew up in families like this, grew up in maybe even temptations in our own kind of Christianity in this direction, but where we embrace, fundamentally kind of embrace the world around us and its worldview and its approach to morality and its approach to who God is and what the world is like. And we talk about Jesus and we, at least at the beginning, have a deep love for Jesus. And yet Jesus would say that both of these things are deadly compromises that will kill us. It's interesting that the threat being set before these churches, if you don't repent, if you don't turn back from both of these ways of destruction, I will come and remove your lampstand. And we know from history that for several of these churches, he did precisely that. The church in Ephesus, within 100 years of this being written, no longer exists. We know this. This is the temptations that we face. So how do we, as a church, trying to navigate and what feels like, and two places that are very, very easy to fall, how do we navigate it? And here's where we're in. Jesus comes back again and again to say, here's who I am and what I'm like. And then he speaks to those churches. He reminds each church, he reminds us of who he is and what he's like, what his character is, that he's gracious and holy, that he's righteous and true, that he is filled with grace and mercy and kindness and love, and his judgments are severe and terrifying and will unravel the very world. In other words, over and over again, as he addresses all of these churches, he begins his address by saying, look at me. Consider again what I'm like. So I believe that the call to these seven churches and the call to us, no matter which direction we're tempted in and which direction we eventually are tempted in and which direction you particularly are tempted in, the call is again and again and again and again, come back and look at Jesus with clear eyes, seeing him as he is, as the Holy One who will not tolerate sin at all. And as the gracious one who meets us in kindness and mercy, forgiving our sins over and over and over and over again. of the call of Jesus, the way that we make our way through this world, navigate this world, is to see him. To see him as he is, to tremble before his holiness, and to marvel at his kindness. Let's pray.